You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, July 20th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. It is hump day! Oh, thank God. Thank God it's Wednesday, ladies and gentlemen. Today on the program, the ongoing saga of the so-called raise the debt ceiling deal. Just how much will we be screwed? David Dayen from Fire Dog Lake will be here to tell us exactly how much we will be screwed. Also on the program today, good news coming out of Wisconsin. Not totally unexpected, but still good news. Some good news coming on the front to provide equal rights to all Americans, and some speculation as to whether or not News Corp will be subjected to the Foreign Corporate Corruption Act, whatever it is that the Obama administration would never, ever, ever prosecute. But we shall look into that. A little warm out there today, apparently everywhere. What would you say the temperature is? About 100 degrees out today in New York City?
It I don't know. It feels so awful. I haven't been outside for more
than
3 seconds.
It's awful. And it's not just New York City. All across the country, Abilene, Texas, 100 degrees or above for 40 days this summer. Savannah, Georgia, 90 degrees or more for 56 days in a row. Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, their driest nine-month stretch since 1895. That was back when they had really much better prayer-to-rain technology. Heidi Cullen writing in the New York Times. Apparently, she's some type of scientist. so, of course, none of these facts and figures mean anything. She is a scientist at Climate Central. Yeah, right. Of course. I wonder how much she sits down to have donuts with Al Gore. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, she writes, calculates the new normals every 10 years on the 30-year averages of temperature and precipitation. And they update it every 10 years. The latest numbers released earlier this month show that the climate of the last 10 years was about 1.5 degrees warmer than the climate of the 1970s. And the warmest since the first decade of the last century. Don't you understand, folks? It is not getting warmer. Those numbers are generated just to make Al Gore rich. The average annual temperatures for all of the lower 48 states have gone up over the past 10 years. Heat-trapping pollution at least doubled the likelihood of that infamous European heat wave that killed more than 30,000 people during the summer of 2003. This is according to a study in the journal Nature of 2004. Summers like that one will happen every other year by 2040, the study warned. Using climate models, we can project what the future Julys might look like. By 2050, assuming we continue on pumping the heat-trapping pollution into our atmosphere at a rate similar to today's, and we know that despite the massive recession that hit most of the globe the past couple of years, that we did not in any way slow the production of these heat-trapping gases. By 2050, New Yorkers can expect the number of July days exceeding 90 degrees to double, and those exceeding 95 degrees to roughly triple. Sweltering days in excess of 100 degrees, rare now, will become a regular feature of the Big Apple's climate in the 2050s. Let me do a quick back of the book. I'm going to be in my 70s at that time. And currently, we are training our daughter, Mila, to breathe out of gills, which apparently makes it much easier when it's warm and sticky and humid. It's not easy to train her. We went from teaching her how to read right into breathing out of her chest. We are going in to talk to a doctor soon to see if we can surgically actually create the gills. And hopefully maybe she'll get a swimming scholarship too. So we kill two birds with one stone there. Don't have to pay for college. Don't have to worry about her. When New York City turns into just like the atmosphere just turns into some type of like miasma. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to David Dayan, who will give us the latest on the debt ceiling deal. It ain't going to be pretty. It never is. We'll be right back for this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, you all know, you all perceive me to be the hardest working person in the news commentary biz. I submit to you that on the phone we have the hardest working person in the news gathering reportage biz. I still don't understand. I'm convinced that he must have some secret twin that he keeps in the basement who just searches for news stories on a daily basis. Ladies and gentlemen, David Dayan of Fire Dog Lake News. He is the news editor over there. I honestly don't know how you do it.
Sam, this is the most humbled day of my life. You said that.
There you go. Well, we'll be delivering a pie to you shortly in honor of that. That was wonderful, wasn't it? I mean, the pie thing, I felt like, you know, poorly timed. Why give a guy any sympathy when he's being humiliated publicly like that? But that was quite a show yesterday.
I'm just focusing on the fact that this guy runs a newspaper or several, and said this is the most humbled day of my life, which is massively grammatically incorrect. Obviously, he did not come up through the copy editing part of the business in order to achieve his stature and success.
What's also amazing is he seems to this whole massive corporation seems to run on its own. He doesn't
apparently.
You can.
I mean, this is the dirty secret, though, right? I mean, what CEO knows anything that's actually going on at their business? They take plenty of credit when the business succeeds. When it doesn't, I don't know. Talk to the middle managers.
Yeah, I've got employees all across the country. They're giving away $1 million here and there, and when I talk to them on the phone, I don't even want to hear that. I just want to hear, tell me the good story. What's happening with Lindsay Lohan? Unbelievable. But that's not why you're here, David. In fact, you're not even here. You're on the phone. But
I'm not.
That's why you're not on the program today. While there were those of us who were just fixated on watching the Murdoch empire crumble, you were getting the latest details on the latest proposal, which you will tell us, will it go anywhere? Apparently, the Gang of Six has been resurrected. It went from the Six to the Five because Coburn scattered. Then Coburn went out on his own. Now they're back to the Six. What have they come up with?
Well, this is what's interesting. I mean, yesterday, about 50 senators walked into a room, and the Gang of Six gave a proposal for, I believe, $3.7 trillion in deficit reduction over 10 years. But they worked on this for, 7 months? Most of the people on this panel, on the Gang of Six, were involved in the Bowles-Simpson Fiscal Commission, what we call the Cat Food Commission.
Right.
What they came up with is pretty much the recommendations from Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson, which inevitably eventually didn't pass the commission. They worked for 7 months on this. The overwhelming amount of recommendations in their plan, that they call plan, which is a four-page outline, is to say that we will reduce budgets in this category by this amount, and the Committee of Jurisdiction will figure it out.
Right. It's.
I mean,
it's
that's the majority of the plan. It's a plan to make a plan.
It's the functional equivalent of me saying, "Hey, Evan, here's the plan. You're going to get a 40% increase in members over the next 6 months. That's the plan. Go ahead, get on it."
Go execute.
Yes.
Right.
Do that.
I mean, in budget terms, they call this a magic asterisk. You know, they say that we're going to reduce health spending to this amount, and we will reduce it. And how they will reduce it is that they will reduce it. And that's most of the plan. The parts that are specific are arguably quite a bit worse than the parts that are general.
Right. At least the generality is not a situation where it's like a across the board cap on things, which would be absolutely horrific, have horrific implications. At least this simply says, like, you guys go figure it out.
Right. But there is across the board caps involved in this, and budget reform processes and things like this that will ratchet down spending and force a certain level of spending. One of the two other specific things on this are really horrifying. One is the chain CPI, which is a very kind of wonkish thing, which essentially is a recalculation of the cost of living adjustment. So every year in a variety of federal programs, including Social Security, including veterans benefits, including a host of others, there is a cost of living adjustment that changes at the rate of inflation. Well, they want to use a different calculator for how you calculate inflation, essentially, than what is being used now. And they're not doing that so that it will be more generous. They're doing that so it will be less generous and save money. So what it amounts to is a benefit cut in Social Security. Interestingly enough, it also amounts to a tax increase, because one of the other things that uses a cost of living adjustment calculator are your tax brackets. And if they rise more slowly, then you get bumped up into the higher tax bracket, even with the same level of income. So, and not only is that a tax increase, it's a regressive tax increase, because of course there aren't that many tax brackets up at the top. So, basically, the one really specific plan that they have is a benefit cut in Social Security, veterans benefits, food stamps, things like that, paired with a regressive tax cut.
So that's
the specific thing.
This is to address the fact that we all know that social, you know, that seniors, retirees who rely on Social Security, 60% of them rely on Social Security for over 50% of their income. We all know these people have been getting away with murder. Because of this, the way that we calculate increases relative to inflation, these people have been going to the Côte d'Azur. They've been spending their time in Cannes. How many times do you see one of these Social Security types heading over to the Cannes Film Festival, and they do it because of these inflation increases? We're going to get that out of the way so that there's no more going to Cannes. And the only
what's hilarious about that is that the new calculation includes this thing called the substitution effect, so that if you can't afford meat, you will buy chicken. If you can't afford a vacation to Cannes, you will go to Bakersfield. So, but, you know, what is the one thing that seniors spend more of their money on than anything else? That would be health care. And there's not really a substitution effect for health care. If you don't want a new hip, you get a slightly used hip. I don't know that that exists.
Right. If you need dialysis, what you really need to do is just go take a walk.
Right. Or a washing machine to somehow throw your blood into. But, you know, that's essentially the premise upon which this is based. And the fact is that the current cost of living adjustment calculator, the current CPI, doesn't account for healthcare spending, which rises much faster than inflation, which is the number one expense for seniors. This would actually make that worse, not better.
And so this is a stealth cut on Social Security, essentially.
Absolutely.
The only aspect of this that is the silver lining here, I guess, and it's a very, very narrow lining. It may be just a hint of a shadow of a silver lining, is that because it does nominally raise taxes, and like you say, it's a regressive tax cut because there's only so many tax brackets, and once you get pushed up into the highest tax bracket, you're there anyways.
Well, that's just chain CPI, and I can talk about the other tax issues in here.
Well, I want to move to that. But this could be this element could also be the poison pill that will not allow the Republican House members to approve a plan like this. Yes,
potentially. I mean, Grover Norquist has come out against chain CPI. A couple other people have on the right. I think that where the House Republican objections will come is in the broader tax reform elements of this plan, which seeks to raise, well, I mean, depending on how you count it, it either raises $1 trillion or it's a $1.5 trillion tax cut. Now, the Republicans who in the Senate, the part of the Gang of Six who are pushing this plan, call it a tax cut because it doesn't raise as much as you would under current law if the Bush tax cuts were just allowed to expire.
All right, let's walk through this, because this is where it gets a little bit hairy.
It is complicated.
Right now, when the CBO scores something, it basically determines what the income versus expenditures will be. They include the demise of the Bush tax cuts for everyone because statutorily those are going to run out. That presumes no deal to
at the end of 2012.
End of 2012. So that's the baseline that they use. But this deal that the Gang of Six has come up with essentially takes that expiration off the table and then goes from there. Correct?
Yes, I mean it's hard to kind of make out because it's a four-page outline, but it seems to incorporate the expiration of the high-end Bush tax cuts from a revenue standpoint. So it raises that revenue, which is I think $700 billion over 10 years, and it adds on top of that a $1 trillion increase. But how is this increase devised? It will change our tax rates. We only have three tax brackets. Those rates will be lowered. The top tax rate could be as low as 23%, and then they will cut a variety of what are called tax expenditures. Some of them are loopholes, but others are just broad things like the mortgage interest deduction or the charitable deduction, or large deductions that cost a lot of money, a lot of revenue coming to the government. So what you're seeing is a lowering of the rates and what they call broadening of the base, so that there are less deductions. Now, the last time we did this in the 80s with tax reform under Reagan, the rates stayed low, the loopholes and deductions came back. And
right.
I think that it's clear that that's what would happen from a political standpoint. I mean, we have a president who has touted 16 small business tax cuts since he came into office. Well, those are all tax loopholes or tax expenditures or things in the tax code that they want to eliminate. But, you know, they're obviously very popular, and they're just the kinds of things that presidents and members of Congress implement later on to encourage growth or whatever they use to justify.
I'm actually going to paraphrase Fred Grandy here, if you can imagine. Fred
Please
Grandy,
do.
Former congressman,
former
also
congressman.
Former gopher on the Love Boat. When I was on the Kudlow Report with him, he sat on that committee, I guess, must have been a Ways and Means Committee probably, back during the mid-80s when Reagan, this omnibus tax bill basically went through. And he said exactly what you're saying. He said, we cut the tax rates, we got rid of the loopholes, and by the time I left Congress, all the loopholes were back, and that starved us of revenue. And this is a right-wing, gopher, as it were. And so we're looking at the same type of situation here, but the plan as it is at the end of the day ends up being a $1.5 trillion tax cut, to the extent that you can understand this plan, correct?
Yes, and there are other things involved with it, including the elimination of the alternative minimum tax, which is a whole other sidelight that I don't want to get into just yet. Let me just add two things. One, the plan, the grand bargain plan that Barack Obama wants to put forward, that he tried to put forward with John Boehner, that House Republicans essentially rejected, was a plan to cut the deficit by $4 trillion over 10 years, with $1 trillion of that being used, being done through revenue increases. The budget plan that the Gang of Six just put forward cuts the deficit by $3.7 trillion, or close to $4 trillion, with $1 trillion of tax increases. I don't see the difference between the two plans where Republicans in the House are suddenly going to say, oh, I get it. Okay, now I'll go for that. Because this is exactly, practically, the same thing that they just rejected. So the idea that House Republicans will jump at this plan is extremely dubious, and in fact, John Boehner's office has already said that they find it falls short in certain areas.
And Dick Durbin has said that we're not even going to have this plan ready in time by August 2nd, because what we really have is a plan to make a plan, and we don't really know the numbers on this thing.
Right, exactly. You have a four-page outline. CBO said the Congressional Budget Office, which does the scoring around Congress in terms of what legislation actually costs, said it would take 2 weeks to score. We don't have 2 weeks. I think it actually raises the likelihood of default that this has come into play, this plan at this late date that can't actually get done in time, but now there's a whole lot of incentive for senators to hold out and say, well, you should incorporate this part of the plan, or you should just do a short-term increase and give us more time to put this plan together. Now you're going to have a million different opinions on how to try to wedge this Gang of Six plan into the debt limit talks. And it's very dangerous at this point. I mean, we're less than 2 weeks away.
Is this just a big cover-your-ass exercise? I mean, are these guys just going like, you know, I'm going to just make it look like I'm working on this thing when, in fact, I'm not?
Well, it could be. But I mean, they've been wanting to do this for some time. As I said, this is the result of a seven-month negotiation process between three Democrats and three Republicans. The president is obviously on board with it.
Right.
This amounts to the plan that he asked for. This is similar to the Bold Simpson plan. I think that there's a genuine belief on the part of Democrats many of them, at least, maybe not in the House, but certainly a good bit in the Senate and the president, that we need to cut these deficits, that somehow austerity will expand the economy, that it will create confidence in the business community, that it will bring us, will allow to get us to get deficits off the table, and then we can start talking about job creation. All of these different theories that they have to put this forward, but really, you know, what you have is a plan that lowers tax rates for the richest people in America. It cuts the safety net, including Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid. It constrains budgets far into the future, sets up a two-thirds vote if you want to get rid of some of the global budget controls that are on here, which means that during a time of recession, you wouldn't be able to increase the deficit in any meaningful way. It's a recipe for disaster. And it's a terrible, terrible idea to do, especially at this time when we still have 14 million people out of work.
All right. Well, this is one of those moments where I have to hit this button to make us all feel better.
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd. Lay, hoodlay, hoodlay.
It's the way that we cheer ourselves up around here. Just think about all the kids, you know, doing the puppet show. Everything's going to be fine. We're going to escape Austria. We're all going to march in our in the garments that we've built, that we've made from our curtains, and we're just going to walk over the mountainside, and everything's going to be fine. We'll all live in a chalet in Vermont. Let's just turn briefly to the House. Steny Hoyer, of all people, came out and said any benefit cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid are off the table. Do you believe him? Does he include the chain CPI in that calculation? Is this just more bullshit? Or just people? Let me put it this way. Are the parties involved in this now just basically setting themselves up for the aftermath of this default?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, until yesterday, it seemed like that there was this sort of kabuki theater that was going on to get us to a point where McConnell Reed, which had less spending cuts, it had this entitlement commission, which is pretty dangerous, and sort of politically gave the ability for Republicans to avoid having to vote for raising the debt limit. Seemed like that was going to be the plan, and that could still be the plan. You know, I think the Gang of Six thing kind of throws a wrench into that. As for Hoyer, you know, I think that chain CPI probably isn't included in his calculation on that. I think that provider cuts, he's talking about benefit cuts, provider cuts to Medicaid or federal participation reductions in Medicaid, which could lead to providers not accepting Medicaid, would be on the table for him. The Progressive Caucus has put together a list of, I think they're up to 70 lawmakers who have said that they will not vote for anything that cuts Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and they include all of the things I just said in that. So there is sort of a block forming. I don't know if it's going to be enough. You have at least a handful of Republicans who aren't going to vote for any increase in the debt limit, no matter what the deal is. So that does give Democrats in the House a little bit of leverage, and hopefully they'll use it.
All right. Well, let's just turn for 1 second, since you've now thoroughly depressed us. Depress us just with this latest that, you know, we've talked to you in the past about this phenomena of robo-signers, essentially mortgage companies as they securitize these mortgages and sell them off to other entities. Instead of going down to the local county or municipal office of clerks and actually recording the transference of these mortgages, they set up their own system, an electronic system called MERS, which has been found in many states, including New York State, is my understanding, to not be a legitimate proof or evidence of chain of title, and have not and foreclosures have been thrown out on this basis because the owner of the mortgage, or the supposed owner of the mortgage, can't prove that they actually own the mortgage to foreclose upon people's houses. This practice was supposedly stopped, and we were just dealing with the aftermath, but that's not the case, is it?
Yeah, the robo-signing, which is the having employees at these mortgage servicers just sign off on documents and claim to attest to the legitimacy of the documents when they know nothing of what's inside, when they don't even do the signing themselves. They're forged documents, they're fabricated documents. That is what is ongoing. And several registers of deeds, which you mentioned, have undertaken investigations in their own offices, looking at the documents, because eventually the documents get to the registers of deeds offices, even though they're being circumvented in certain parts of the process. So, you know, certain registers of deeds, Jeff Thigpen in North Carolina, John O'Brien in Massachusetts, Curtis Hertel in Michigan, did investigations of the documents in their own offices, and they found that there were still robo-signed documents sitting in their offices that were still coming in, you know, dated this year, well after the robo-signing scandal really hit in September and October of last year, after mortgage servicers took a moratorium on all foreclosures until they cleaned up their operations. Since they testified in Congress that they had stopped the practice, since the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency created consent decrees, essentially penalizing orders for mortgage servicers to clean up their act, since all of these things have happened, none of the processes apparently have changed among the big mortgage servicers. They're still robo-signing. They're still using low-level employees to sign off on documents that they have no clue about. They're still using other employees in the office to sign that person's name. They're still committing frauds upon state courts and state land records.
And so do you think we're going to see more action by state attorney generals, particularly in those three states?
It could be. It seems that, I mean, this is a real yeoman effort by the registers of deeds to use the evidence sitting in their offices to prove, to do the investigation and prove that there are many, many of these documents that are, in fact, illegal. I mean, they've been trying to get the attention of people for a long, long time on this, and the Associated Press and Reuters came out with these articles yesterday that finally blew the lid off this a little bit. I know that the Attorney General in Minnesota has contacted some of these registers of deeds to, you know, consult their documents and in help with their investigations on robo-signing. Other registers of deeds in these other states are joining with their state attorneys general to work on this. I know that Eric Schneiderman, the Attorney General of New York, is looking at these reports very carefully. He has been reluctant to sign on to the state attorney general settlement that they're trying to do on robo-signing with the banks. I don't know how you do a settlement when you just find out that these processes are ongoing. You know, this is the thing you're supposed to be settling on, and they're not, they haven't changed their operations one bit. You know, so there is more activity now. And the biggest problem with the industry right now is that there has not been a thorough investigation of their practices. The registers of deeds have put us on a good path to actually investigate the depth of the problem. And I don't think you can do any kind of settlement, and people who I talk to in Congress agree with me, can't do any kind of settlement unless you know what you're settling about. And so hopefully this will start the process, start the movement towards getting some real accountability.
From your mouth to God's ears. David Dayan, news editor at Fire Dog Lake, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hope to speak to you again soon as we watch this debt ceiling fiasco. Fiasco 8. Is that the word? Is that the verb for that? creating more fiasco-ness?
Fiascate.
We're going to get a fiasco-ectomy soon. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll come right back. A couple of news stories. A couple of good stories when we come back. Happy stories. We'll be right back. All right, folks, the first of nine recall elections in the state of Wisconsin took place yesterday. Again, six Democrats will be, or I should say six Republicans will face recall elections in the coming weeks. Three Democrats facing recall elections. The first of those three Democrats, Dave Hansen, Wisconsin State Senator, faced a recall election yesterday, easily, just trounced his Republican challenger, David Vanderleest. I mean, it was 32 points they trounced. His name could have been Vandermost, and he probably wouldn't even gotten below double digits. He just got trounced. If there is only one challenger in a recall election, there is no primary. And we know that all the Democrats face primary challenges from fake Democrats. In this case, there was only one Republican, so they just had this election. There are two remaining recall general elections against the Democrats, I think Holpern and Wirch, which will take place on August 16th. And on August 9th, general elections will be held in six races targeting incumbent Republicans. So on August 9th, we will really have a sense of what's happening. It'll be interesting to see how much money comes into those races on August 16th. I mean, there needs to be a net gain of three Democrats out of these nine elections. And now, out of these eight elections, there needs to be a net gain of three Democrats. So August 9th will be the big day, ladies and gentlemen. But that's good. It's good to see that trouncing. Hopefully, that trend will continue. Meanwhile, good news on the... hopefully good news on the quest to allow all Americans to enjoy the same rights that are bestowed upon them if they decide to get married. And, you know, I'll tell you something. I'm trying not to be cynical here, folks. But there is a pattern where the Obama administration makes a move, reiterates, comes out stronger on some social issues when they're screwing us on economic issues. Today, the Senate Judiciary Committee is holding a hearing on the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act. This is a federal legislation that essentially says that the federal government does not recognize the marriage of two gay or lesbian people. And therefore, if you are married legally in Massachusetts, it doesn't carry over to other states unless those states have legalized gay marriage as well. So Dianne Feinstein's got this legislation to repeal DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. And Jay Carney, at a press briefing yesterday, said Obama was proud to support the Respect for Marriage Act, which is a repeal of the DOMA Act. He has supposedly long favored the repeal of the 1996 measure. He has instructed his Department of Justice not to defend Section 3 of the law in a federal court case. But by backing Feinstein's measure, according to Ivor Volsky at Think Progress, Obama's also signaling his opposition to Section 2 of the statute, which stipulates that same-sex marriages, unlike heterosexual marriages, shall not be automatically recognized across state lines unless the state has legalized marriage. That's the central tenet of the Defense of Marriage Act. And so at least Obama has moved in that right direction so that he can screw us in other areas. And meanwhile, virtually all health insurance plans could soon be required to offer female patients free coverage of prescription birth control, breast pump rentals, counseling for domestic violence, and annual wellness exams and HIV tests. This is a result of recommendations released Tuesday by an independent advisory panel of health experts. These guidelines were suggested by a committee of the National Academy of Science Institute of Medicine. They're not binding, but it is customary for the Health and Human Services Secretary, in this case Kathleen Sebelius, to accept these recommendations. And as part of the Affordable Care Act that was passed last year, these recommendations could go into effect as soon as they are issued by Sebelius. I guess they would have to adopt these guidelines, private insurers, within a year of issuance by the Health and Human Services Secretary. Of course, the right wing is up in arms about this because it's not just abortion they have a problem with. They have a problem with contraception. Because only God can be your condom. Only God can be your birth control. If God looks down on you and says, your supposed rubber broke, maybe I will take my godly finger and plug that little hole so that the semen doesn't escape. Or maybe I'm too busy working on the whole rain issue in Texas and I didn't have a chance to put my finger on that little tiny hole in your condom. And if that's the way I decide to do it, it's the way I decide to do it. I'm the one who wears the robe. I'm the one with the big white beard. I'm the one floating on a cloud. So if I decide you get pregnant, you have to be pregnant. You women don't have right over your own sovereignty over your own body. I'm God! Listen, I can do this. I didn't even have to move my finger to do that. That's just, I just like, flip of the tongue is the way I do this. That's God. I could take my staff and plug that hole in your condom, but I'm not going to. Not today. Maybe I'll do it tomorrow. Maybe I'll do it tomorrow for somebody else. And as God, I command ye, become a Majority Report member at majority.fm, or I shall unleash hellfire upon you. You think this heat wave is bad? If there are not 10 new Majority Report members, I will make it even hotter. You'll all be pregnant. And also, as your lord, I command you, go to justcoffee.coop. Buy some fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, and I, God, shall give you a 10% discount. And also, if you buy crap via Amazon, buy it through the majority.fm link. Do it now, I command ye! All right, folks, see you on the flip side. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can call me at 646-257-3920. We'll see you tomorrow.